Good morning. Hey, Chris. Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and begin our program. I think we probably are expecting a few more of our registered guests to join us, which means they get to come in while we're in motion, and they get to sit in the front. So that's just the price you pay. You have to sit in the front. Welcome. Thank you very much to all of you for being with us today. And I'm going to make sure we get to the right, there we go, that first slide. My name is Beth Bechtel. I'm the president and CEO of Agrinovis Indiana, and I'm pleased to be able to partner on this event with BioCrossroads, our peer organization inside the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership. And I will tell you, it's proving to be an outstanding partnership, and I'll tell you a little bit more in my opening comments about some of the other collaborative opportunities that we have as Agrinovis by being a part of the CICP and being connected to many of its different sector initiatives. I want to begin just by thanking one of our sponsors, Miles Printing, who always, for BioCrossroads and for these Frameworks events, does a great job in putting together our printed material, and so I want to make sure that I give them credit for their investment in this. I also want to make sure that I reference a few folks in the room. We do have a few of our Executive Steering Committee members who are here with us today from our Agrinovis board, Kay Kinker from Dow AgriSciences, who you'll hear from a little bit further in the program, and our Lieutenant Governor, Sue Elsperman, also serves on that steering committee. And I see representatives from many of our other stakeholder investors who are here, who you will also, I think, be hearing from through the course of today's program. So we very much thank them for coming. I also know that we have representatives from Senator Coates and Senator Donnelly's office, so thank you very much for joining us in this discussion as well. Before I begin with some opening comments about this interesting intersection, I think, that we're finding ourselves in today between the food and agricultural sector and the life sciences sector, I would like to ask Lieutenant Governor Elsperman to come and provide some brief welcoming remarks.
Thank you, Beth. I just want to say I am so pleased to be a part of the Agrinovis Indiana initiative, representing the state of Indiana, and this frameworks and this initiative with CICP. You know, we know what a big deal agriculture is in Indiana. I get to serve as Secretary of Agriculture here, $44 billion in economic impact to our state. But more importantly, it's home to such very important companies in both the agribusiness, agriculture, agribusiness, food, and thrilled to see this. But I'm most thrilled about the work that we're doing in Agrinovis, Indiana, which is really going to bring together the innovation components that are happening in this state. So, Beth, I want to say thank you to you and Brian on the great work you do, CICP, for the great work they do across the Central Indiana, but much further with all the initiatives. And looking forward to a great Frameworks experience. Thank you.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. I want to take just a few more minutes this morning before we move into some of our industry speakers and academic speakers and give you some context to, I think, get your mind around the intersection of these two sectors, these two disciplines, and the importance of both of them, the food and agricultural sector and the life sciences sector here to the state of Indiana. I think, as many of you know, we can strongly assert many of these competitive strengths, and especially when we're thinking about the agricultural production sector, it's really pretty undeniable that Indiana is a national leader in so many important agricultural commodity sectors, whether that's in the crops, livestock, or even specialty product sectors. Indiana ranks very high, whether it's in terms of output, productivity, or even sales and exports in many of these different sectors. And what I want to do today is just continue to connect some of these dots for you, to connect some of these different strengths, number of these different competitive assets, and help you, I think, see that the opportunity for greater collaboration here in Indiana between a number of these what may have once been viewed as very disparate sectors, sort of unusual bedfellows, you might say, that really there is a lot more overlap, a lot more synergy, and a lot more connectedness and potential linkages between and among these disciplines. This next slide is a really important aspect of the story that Agrinovis is in place to tell. While it's important for Agrinovis to continue to assert that production base strength that Indiana agriculture has, it's also very important for us to focus on the innovation assets, the technology assets, the R&D assets that are so prominent here in Indiana. And as we think about the need that we have in this society to produce more food over the next 20, 50, 100 years with a growing world population and a reserved natural resource base, one that must be protected, we all, I think, appreciate the fact that it will come in many different shapes, sizes, and forms, but innovation, research and development, and technology will have to be probably the most significant part of helping us achieve the solutions that are needed to those particular challenges. And a big part of the story then that Indiana has to put forward today is not only do we have the production assets to help meet those challenges, but we also have the talent and the R&D and the innovation assets. And so we sometimes, I think, don't tell the story of our leadership, our national and global leadership in the ag biosciences, in the R&D part of food and agriculture. But when you think about the global headquarters and research operations that are here of so many leading food and agricultural companies in a diverse number of sectors, and when you also recognize the world-class university research and educational programs at no longer just Purdue, and as a Boilermaker, I want to say just Purdue, but we can't anymore. Today in Indiana, we have a wide variety of top level research and curriculum and education institutions that are now finding their niche, their opportunity to provide research, to provide talented young people, to provide unique collaborative opportunities in food and agriculture. And so this, too, is a critical strength of our state's economy. We also, and this is the BioCrossroads part of the story, we also are a leading life sciences state. Our life sciences industry delivers a $59 billion economic impact to this state. And when you look at the strengths that contribute to that life sciences biotechnology sector, those are many of the same critical ingredients for success that we need to have in the food and agricultural sector, whether that's university and academic institutions who are highly engaged, strong philanthropic support, unique and novel public-private partnerships. We'll be hearing about one of those at the end of our program today, the Indiana Biosciences Research Institute. Our workforce, our business climate, and also a much more vibrant than ever before startup, entrepreneurial, spirited environment here in Indiana. We are home in the life sciences sector to nearly 2,000 companies with more than 56,000 life sciences working across a number of organizations that are listed on this slide. Some are global headquarters who are based here in Indiana. Some are North American headquarters based here in Indiana. And others are organizations that simply have very significant R&D workforce manufacturing presence here in our state. And when you put these two spaces into comparison, you see on this particular slide that we have 56,000 life sciences workers. Our work recently at Agrinovis tied to the ag biosciences sector demonstrates that there is an additional 70,000 employees that focus on that R&D innovative part of food and agricultural development, all again connecting and linking our strengths in these two different disciplines and bringing them more and more closely in alignment. The four sectors that are identified on this particular chart simply are meant to remind many of you who are familiar with the early work of Agrinovis and to give those of you maybe not so familiar a little taste of the four innovation sectors in food and agriculture that we focus on primarily and that we already acknowledge here in Indiana we have significant strengths in. Some, too, are positioned on this particular slide and in our activities because as we think about the changing dynamics of food and agriculture, we know that some of the most innovative technologies and investments in this sector are coming in a few of these unique innovation sectors. Plant improvement sciences and crop protection, animal health and nutrition, value-added human food and nutrition, and also what we call high-tech ag as that last one. That's everything from UAVs to drones to sensors to big data in agriculture, precision agriculture technologies, all with an effort to helping us produce more with less resources than what we've done in the past. All four of these, as I said, are spaces where here in Indiana, if we were to have more time to tell you and dive into each one of these areas, I think you would walk away feeling like we have a really strong base of companies who are developing really amazing technologies and services and platforms in each of these areas. But there are also huge areas of economic development opportunity, R&D opportunity, because these are sectors where that technology and R&D innovation are going to need to come as agriculturists look to again, find these bigger answers to big problems, but also as agriculture is in some ways forced and finding good partnerships to work with in terms of these other sectors like the life sciences sector. I want to just close by sharing with you the structure, the model by which Agrinovis is organized. We are the newest member of the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership Sector Initiative, and I think probably for most of you in the room, especially if you're familiar with BioCrossroads and the Framework Series, understand much of what these other organizations do, but yet perhaps you didn't realize how connected we all were to one another. When I talk to different groups, they well recognize the names of Connexus and TechPoint and BioCrossroads. But I think it's critically important to share with all of you today that for Agrinovis to be aligned and to be a sister or a peer initiative or organization to each of these other groups, to BioCrossroads, to Energy Systems Network, Connexus, and TechPoint, is I think one of the most critical longer-term ingredients to our success. Because as you think about the purpose of what we're here to talk about today, linkages, connectivity, need for collaboration between a food and agriculture sector and a life sciences sector, that's where you see the advantage that comes for us in Indiana by having one organization with many different efforts involved, but yet collaborating, working together, and finding those connective strengths between a BioCrossroads and an Agrinovis. If we were here today to talk high-tech ag, if we were here today to talk about big data and drones and startup companies and IT-oriented topics, I would be saying the same point to you, but I would be drawing an immediate parallel between Agrinovis and TechPoint. Because when you think about the efforts of that membership and of its core leaders, you really understand the significant place that it is putting us in terms of entrepreneurial, tech-oriented, data-oriented platforms. So it's exciting for us as Agrinovis to be attached and associated with the Central Indiana Corporate Partnership for the exact reasons, really, that we're here today, to allow us the opportunity to bring these kinds of partnerships together in a much more expeditious and, frankly, just a more time-sensitive, easy, and very collaborative way. And my last two slides, I just wanted to make sure that I gave credit and pointed out to you, for those, again, not quite as familiar with Agrinovis, who our initial investors and stakeholders are. You'll see the logos of many of the companies, the organizations, and the institutions that have provided funding and other talent-related support to Agrinovis, and we're very thankful for their continued support. You will notice that it's a very diverse mix across the food and agriculture
agricultural sector. And I'd also point out how pleased we are to have the state of Indiana, both through IEDC and ISDA, along with Purdue University, at the table and contributing to our efforts from the very beginning. So let me transition us to the topic today. Again, I think I've said it already, but many food and agricultural businesses who are invested in Indiana and are invested in Agrinovis are also finding partnerships, conducting research, and building great collaborations in the life sciences disciplines. And when you see from a business and a research perspective the development and the movement towards some really important trends, whether it's in the production and development of functional traits, the advancement of whether it's biotech derived or through some other technique, the connection again of crops and crop production to human health, human food, human nutrition is really undeniable. There are also pharmaceutical applications that are occurring today between our agricultural and our life sciences and pharma industries. And we also pay significantly more attention today than I would argue we ever have before to things in the food safety systems, whether that's new processes, new diagnostic systems. These are just a few of the examples of work and research that today is taking place that is very directly connecting agriculture to the nutrition, to the food, and to the life sciences sectors. And so again, these sectors are deeply, deeply connected, both in practice, but also here in Indiana. And I would argue that we have an ideal landscape for more of this kind of collaboration between and among food and agriculture, biotech, pharma, and more traditional life sciences companies to spur more innovation and to spur more collaboration between them. And so with that as a background, I would like to ask our first speaker, someone from an organization who finds themselves already perhaps saying to me, why didn't we talk about this long ago? Because our organization, Dow AgriSciences, has been in this nexus, has been at this intersection point of food and agriculture and the life sciences for a very long time. And so I'd like to ask Kay Kinker to come forward to provide some remarks. Kay is the Vice President of Government Affairs, Public Affairs, and Sustainability for Dow AgriSciences. She's been with their organization for a number of years and has also been there through a number of different roles, has kind of seen it all from top to bottom. And she's, as I mentioned, a member of our Agrinovis Executive Steering Committee. She's involved with BioCrossroads and some of their efforts as well. So is in a perfect, I think, position to be able to share with you today her thoughts and some of the thoughts from Dow AgriSciences about this connection point. So Kay?
Good morning. On behalf of Dow AgriSciences, thank you to BioCrossroads, David Johnson, and Agrinovis, thanks Beth, for the opportunity to participate in today's framework session. Dow AgriSciences specifically was invited to share a few perspectives on the confluence of the life sciences and why Dow AgriSciences sees value in participating actively in each of Agrinovis, Indiana Biosciences Research Institute, and BioCrossroads. Thus the title of today's session, which is really about bridging life sciences and food and ag. At Dow AgriSciences last Friday, we had a sustainability summit, and we brought together both downstream food companies such as PepsiCo and Campbell's with our ag grower customers to connect those varying perspectives. There is and needs to be a growing conversation between the downstream food industry and upstream ag aimed toward affecting the nutritional profile of food at the genetics level. So my themes today will be about commonalities and the importance of collaboration across our industries and the opportunity that we have here in Indiana through venues such as Agrinovis, IBRI, and BioCrossroads. For Dow AgriSciences, it's not so much about bridging. In fact, we already view as what we do as participating in the life sciences sector. Sometimes, however, particularly for those in the public sector and not in the ag field, we still contend with a dated and very narrow perception of what is ag. For many people, this is the perception that comes to mind when you mention agriculture. And it depicts both antiquated technology, at least in the developed world, but also a very narrow slice of what constitutes agriculture, namely the farming component. Modern farm equipment today is state-of-the-art technology. It's high-tech, it's GPS, real-time, precision application, data-intensive, automated, and some of it can be operated hands-free. The fact is, farming today is high-tech, sophisticated, high-risk, and demands keen business skills. But farming is only one component of a broad agricultural value chain. In this depiction, it starts with the input provider, such as Dargher Sciences or Monsanto, Pioneer, etc. We're a provider of seed, biotechnology traits, crop protection chemicals, etc. Past the grower, we can see subsequent handoffs, the off-takers and processors, like ADM, Bunge, Cargill, to food manufacturers, retailers, and finally to the consumer. But even this view of ag doesn't tell the whole story. On one hand, only 1% of our U.S. population is working on a farm, directly involved in food production. So about 99% of people have or have a risk of really losing touch with where does food come from. In our age of social media and as consumer consciousness is increasing more and more about how food is produced, there's a widening gap even more between perception and reality. Those of us in agriculture need to broaden the conversation to one about food and mitigate this gap and misperceptions about ag. And in food, everyone is an expert or at least has an opinion. So those are some comments about ag and farming and changing the conversation to be more about food. Relative to other life sciences, whether a bridge or not, industry is subject to the same world's megatrends, which I'm sure all of us in this room know well. In fact, Beth mentioned many of them during her opening remarks. So a commonality, we're all subject to the same world trends. We've got more than 7 billion people today. By 2050, we'll have over 9 billion on the planet. And that's like adding 156,000 people per day or a new Dayton, Ohio, coming onto the planet every day. We'll be dependent on the same water and land resources that we have today, and we're using the planet's resources 50% faster than it can take. And an estimated one-third of the world's food is wasted each year, despite the fact that 1 billion people almost don't have enough calories every day, and on the other end, 1.9 billion people are either overweight or obese. The way we're going is not sustainable, and there's a widening gap between the haves and the have-nots. We need to both produce more food with no more arable land and water, and we have to cut the waste. And the only way to do this is through technology and innovation. While I'd love to talk to you about Dargher Sciences, technology, and meeting those world challenges, it's not one company, one technology, or one country that's going to address these challenges. Rather, the complexity of today's challenges require an unprecedented collaborative effort, one that transcends traditional boundaries between private companies, government, non-governmental organizations, academia, public and private sectors, faith-based and secular. And while there are many successful collaborations that exist, there remains room for improvement, more participation, and better coordination to improve impact and reduce duplication. Not only are all of the life sciences subject to the same world trends, if I crystallize further, I conjecture that all life sciences have a common purpose and a common call to action. Simply stated, the purpose of all life sciences is really to maximize the health and well-being of the patient, and that is whether the patient is a human, a plant, or an animal. And all of this is subject to the health and well-being of the planet. The second thing is that continuous innovation is critical to address the world's challenges. Since Mother Nature really has an innate capability to adapt, she always wins. Whether developing resistance to antibiotics or herbicides, Mother Nature always wins. We need to use technology wisely. In our business, we do that through practices like crop rotation and integrated pest management and continuously innovate. More about innovation later. And the common purpose is just the tip of the iceberg. If we look below the surface, there are numerous other common attributes between the life sciences that we can learn from each other, leverage, and collaborate across sectors. A few of those common attributes are showed under the surface of this iceberg and include things like the product development process. We've all got a extremely high cost of innovation. Products in our industries are generally patent protected for a limited time. And by the way, patent law in one sector can bleed over into other sectors, so it's another reason to collaborate. We are all in a regulated industry governed by policy and subject to approvals from entities like the USDA, the FDA, and EPA. So collaboration and cross-learning around the regulatory framework is another fertile ground for a consistent, functioning, science-based regulatory process is critical for all of our life sciences industries. Other common areas include informatics and the need to be able to manage and analyze huge amounts of data. And last but not least, there's a great opportunity for leveraging human talent across these industry sectors, largely in the sciences, but also in support functions such as IT, finance, supply chain, and relative to human talent, the talent to work in these knowledge-driven technologies is really agnostic to the final application, whether agricultural, medical, so we find ourselves often recruiting a common technology skill set. So I'm going to highlight a little bit more in depth just a couple of these commonalities. The first one is the product development process. Each of pharmaceutical, animal health, and plant sciences industries, we utilize basically the same product development process. We each start with market drivers and our company strategy and asset base, and we develop product goals which drive what product candidates we discover, attain, and develop. The basic stages might be named different. There's basically a discovery stage, an enablement stage, development, and then finally launch it and sell. And you can see on this slide whether we're developing a new seed variety, a biotechnology trait, a new herbicide, a new animal health vaccine, or a new pharmaceutical. The stages are basically the same, and the journey is about 10 to 13 years. The cost of whether you're a seed or a pharmaceutical development is different, but one thing is for sure, the costs are going up. The timelines are becoming longer, and that also compromises the time to recuperate the innovation investment as we go to the market prior to the expiration of our patents. So I want to say a word about innovation, particularly in these regulated industries like crop protection, animal health, and pharmaceuticals. The process, I said, is expensive and long. The time required to bring this technology, as you can see on the slide, is 10 to 13 years on average. Industry average cost for a new crop protection chemical, for instance, this is according to CropLife America's 2008 industry data. It exceeds $250 million for one new crop protection chemical and exceeds $130 million for a biotechnology trait. Over that 10-year period up to 2008, those costs have doubled and continue to increase. So why is it so expensive? Well, the primary drivers are the time and the cost to conduct studies required for regulatory data packages around the world. Therefore, only a few companies are positioned to participate, largely because of that R&D expense and the assets and scale required to make new products. So it's really critical for all life sciences companies to make quick kill and wide stage gate advancement decisions during this journey, because the cost of dropping a candidate very late in that process results in significant wasted sunk costs. So this is a place also that we can leverage across industries. How do we screen and make those wise, quick kill decisions? If we look at the next slide, also common across our industries are the exposure to various external forces and influencers. Some of those are good, and some of those are quite challenging. So if we look at this slide, I want to focus on the regulatory component. The issue is not that the products are regulated. If we look at our industry, crop protection chemicals, chemicals and biotechnology, those products should be regulated. So that's not the issue. We are all consumers in this world, and all of us want safe, affordable, and nutritious food. All of us have a right to know what's in our food. There are ways to enable this, some much more costly than others. What we need to do is work together through local, state, and national governments to ensure safe, nutritious, and abundant food at a cost that consumers can afford. So how do we do this? The regulatory process, first and foremost, has to be science-based and be implemented by government agencies like EPA, USDA, and FDA, and the associated state organizations. They need to implement in a timely fashion that science-based process, and that process needs to be one that consumers trust and have confidence in. Over the last several years, competing social, economic priorities, and political agendas and activist pressure have increasingly encroached on this science-based foundation, making the regulatory process often unpredictable, inconsistent, and therefore threatening to the innovation process. So I think one of the most exciting areas of potential collaboration to Dairiger Sciences is one around technology. And this slide lists some of those areas. Our scientists could spend at least an hour on each one of these topics, but let me highlight a few that are of particular interest and we already are or hope to explore via collaborations within IBRI. Some of them already are areas where we're collaborating across life sciences sectors. So in this first one, genome sequencing and editing, one example of technology that can be shared across sectors we call exact precision technology. And it's an example of a collaboration where DAS is using genome editing technology that we licensed exclusively for plant use from a company called Sangamo, who uses the same technology for human health. And what this technology allows us to do is to do site-specific gene insertion, deletion, or up and down regulation. And granted, plant, animal, and human proteins may be different and metabolized differently. However, many of the tools, the know-how, and the analysis methods are leverageable across these sectors. In target site-based discovery, we're already learning from pharma, who uses pre-competitive consortia and technology incubator models to reduce the cost and the risk of the discovery stage. This is something that we're already doing cross-sharing. We also see parallels in systems biology, which I call the omics world. And if we look here, we can couple phenotype with genotype to identify targets which can be used to improve strains. In many of our products, we use natural products based on a biological strain. And we do genetic modification to improve the production process through process optimization. The application of genomics through genome sequencing enables us to map and identify mutations that have been introduced during this strain improvement process. Transcriptomics helps to determine the impact of mutations on the gene expression and on protein expression using proteomics. To couple the expression data to phenotypes, metabolomics is used and integrated into the biochemical reaction network to determine and model pathway fluxes. A newer emerging space for both agriculture and pharma is toxicogenomics, which combines toxicology with genomics and other profiling technologies to understand the molecular basis of a system's response to a candidate compound. You know, and although a gross simplification, we've a really good opportunity to look at parallels between things like precision agriculture and personalized medicine or individualized dosing. Given the incredible computing capabilities that we have in this early 21st century, we are finally in a position to efficiently utilize algorithms that enable us to do real-time and iterative assessments for tailored drug doses based on phenotype and minimal sampling. So what needs to happen to catalyze and unleash this type of interaction and collaboration? I believe it's through innovation or initiatives like BioCrossroads and subsequently IBRI and Agrinovis that bring together these perceived diverse sectors to discuss and explore the what-if. Dairiger Sciences is a very strong global R&D-based company. We have strong culture geared toward collaboration, and you can see that represented in this slide. I know you can't read these, but I want you to note the green color and the yellow color, assuming you're not colorblind. The yellow boxes here really show already collaborations that we have going on across sectors. Most of these are the human health sector with us in plant science. We collaborate with global industry, academia, government entities for licensing, partnership, or even acquisitions that accelerate our innovation process and advance the science in crop protection, plant genetics, biotech, and also enabling technologies. Many of our collaborations are with organizations focused on the human medical space, and we do leverage technologies and capabilities and know-how into our ag space. So in summary, there are numerous parallels between the life sciences, human, animal, and plant. And we know that addressing the world's challenges will not be done by one company, country, or technology. It's going to take a multidisciplinary approach to innovation. We have to bring the best of the best from all the sectors at the table together. So collaboration is going to be key to identifying the how and what can be leveraged to advance against these world challenges. Groups such as Indiana Biosciences Research Institute, which David is going to talk to us about, Agrinovis Indiana, and BioCrossroads, they provide a great forum to grow the conversation and collaborate. And Indiana, as a state, is uniquely suited to capitalize on this bringing together of life sciences because Indiana is host to the world leaders in human, animal, and plant sciences, as well as having world-class academic institutions. Thank you very much.
I told you I would forget, so it gives me pleasure to introduce our next speaker, which is Dr. Brian Farkas. He is the head of the Food Science Department at Purdue, and you can read his bio as well as I can, but I had the privilege of hearing Brian last time at the framework session. It was just a fabulous presentation. I hope I get to hear some of that again. So,
good deal. Thank you, Kay. Okay. Well, thank you everybody for coming. And you'll notice you can hear me and I'm not there. I came early, I got mic'd up, which is really nice. I've been teaching for 27 years or so. I tend to like to roam around the room a little bit and interact with the people. If you start to fall asleep, I'll probably work my way over towards you and perk you up a little bit. Don't worry. I've been in Indiana 2 years now. I came from North Carolina State University in Raleigh, the Research Triangle Park many of you probably have heard of. I was there 20 years. I came to Indiana because of Purdue University. I thought I'd never leave NC State, but when Purdue called, it's not going up to the big leagues from NC State. NC State is a wonderful university, but Purdue is a whole nother level of wow. Fifth in the world for agriculture. My Department of Food Science, is known around the world. When I got called up to food science, that was something. And 2 years now, 2 winters, I think we're going to be here for a while. I'm going to step through a few slides rather quickly. What I want to do is start kind of a big idea a little bit and talk about problem opportunity. Throw a little bit of irritation out there and some of the challenges that we're facing, and then bring it home to Indiana of what we can be doing here in BioCrossroads and agriculture and life sciences and how it all comes together. So, problems. World population, we hear it over and over again now. I think pretty much everybody has heard this a number of times of growing population to somewhere between 9 and 10 billion people by 2050, etc. This is true. People worry, can we feed this many people? And I say absolutely. I have no doubt we will feed 10 billion people. We, because we have Indiana and the other producing agriculture states, because we have the sciences to do it. I will put an aside is that brings out a problem that is beyond our ability to address is what do people do when they're well fed? We have more people. So, bigger problem beyond the scope of this discussion, but I would put that out there to keep in the back of your mind. You know, where do we go at 2050 when we all are successful? Because we will be. I have no doubt in that. It brings an opportunity though, in that we will be able to feed these people. And how are we going to do that? It's a problem. We are in business, though. And so when we look at feeding these people, we're talking about U.S. or developed countries versus the whole world and patterns of consumption. We're not going to sell more food to people in the U.S. We're not going to sell more food. calories. We have plenty of calories in the U.S. and the developed world. Okay? So what does that mean? It means that the U.S. consumer cannot consume more. We can buy more eye watches or whatever, you know, things like that. But what we're going to do is shift. So if you are in the food and ag business, you are essentially looking to shift market trends, consumption, and have people consume your product versus somebody else's. Truth. Okay? So Indiana, if we're interested in addressing this, we need to shift to high-demand, value-added products. This is where our future will be in growth and economy. We will provide the foundation in crops and then also in the processing. We can't continue to ship our raw materials outwards. So, small example that everybody can identify with, or at least is keenly aware of, I like to bring this up, it's a little side passion of mine, is craft beer. A number of years ago, Anheuser-Busch, MillerCoors, just this morning it's announced they're looking at merging, possibly? That's shocking. Anyways, they ignored craft beer. It was like a dust speck. Now it's a different story. Craft beer is taking up a sizable portion of the market where you can get, let's call it a six-pack of large production beverage for $4 or $5. People are actually willing to pay $10, $15 for this craft product. It also consumes more resources in malt, in hops, raw materials. It has a cool factor about it that brings young people in to the center of town, to cities. So it is an interesting kind of study that way. I think we need to be moving towards higher value-added products. On the global stage, though, there's opportunities. That is, to produce, process, and distribute more food. The kicker is, the difficult thing is that we're looking at people who are food insecure, currently, and a growing population. So you're in a rock and a hard place here in that we've got this market that can afford $15 for a six-pack of beer, and we've got a market that can't afford a bottle of water. The way we navigate that and work our way through that is through this, is through agri-sciences, through Purdue University, through IU, all the rest. That's the answer, that we can afford to feed people that are in greater economies, but we can also produce the volume at the price point that the world can afford. So that's something to think about there, and that's an opportunity, not a problem. All right, I want to put out a couple of things, hot topics in food and nutrition. I'm going to step through these, but these are things just to consider that we're dealing with now in the industry. We have the Industrial Roundtable up at Purdue, the largest recruiting fair in the country, I believe is what I understand. Over 450 companies come into Purdue to recruit our students. I've spent the last week with ConAgra and Cargill, General Mills folks. We've got Diageo coming in, numerous food companies. Last night, sitting with Ernest and Julio Gallo from California, the largest wine producer in the world, comes to Purdue to recruit. And the challenges that these companies are facing, not all of them, but the boring things of sodium and sugar reduction, the things that are hitting us, obesity, but some good stuff, the bioactive foods and phytochemicals. So think of blueberries, carotenoids, these things are potentially anti-carcinogen or reverse or slow that process. Food safety is on everybody's mind with salmonella, E. coli, listeria, etc. What do we do about that? So traceability and country of origin. If you're in regulatory, if you're in a food company buying ingredients, this is a huge one. Where did that material come from? How can we detect that? And how can we ensure that it is safe? So toxicology as well. Two, already they've been touched on, GMOs and colorants. natural versus artificial. I have some folks coming over, some faculty coming over to the house on Friday, and from Brazil. They've been hired in to Purdue, all the way from Brazil, and dietary restrictions. One's vegetarian, one is allergic to yellow colorant. And so, you know, this is a world problem, not a U.S. problem, not a, higher income level problem. It's people from all over the world facing these things. So, sustainability is always a topic now. We are bringing in a new faculty member in life cycle analysis, an engineer to work in processing. Alternative proteins and cultured meat. Kay alluded to that a little bit. There's actually an international cultured meat symposium coming up next month. So alternatives to animal produced. I don't know where that's going to go. That's a wild thing. Transparency in the consumer. They are looking to understand what's in our product. I look at food versus pharma. And the consumer attitudes are so different. So different. And I don't know why. I'm an engineer. You know, I do mathematics. But this issue in psychology of the difference between food and pharma and that consumers are good with recombinant organisms producing insulin or other things, but in food, it's just a different gig. You know, we're being held to this natural, which is opportunities, I feel like. Something that I'm very passionate about and don't understand enough is gut microbiome. I think this is the next big thing. Hear me now, believe me later. This is where we need to be. This is research here. I know that in industry, our food industry, they want to know what they can do with it. Now, what do we do? And we're not quite there yet because it's complicated. This is as complicated as sending somebody to the moon. The gut microbiome, we're talking about the ecology within your system, which years ago we thought just was there to help digest the stuff you put in your mouth. That's not true. It affects our physiology. It affects our emotional stability. It upregulates and downregulates possibly epigenetic factors. How we feel in turn affects that flora within our system. So it's a loop. What we put into our mouth changes that flora, which then in turn changes how we feel. Chocolate makes me feel good. I don't know if it's because of the microbiome or it just really tastes delicious, but there's a lot here and a lot of research that needs to be done between food science, nutrition science, biochemistry, medicine, and all the rest. We'll get there, but it's not going to be immediately. All right, just last week, September 3rd, Mintel came out with this report. I'll put this out there as one last bit. 84% of Americans buy free from foods. They prefer this, free from foods. What does that mean? It means it's free from something or other. My dad, who's really the smart Farkas, he's a terrific guy, was out here visiting last week. We came up with a list of 34 free from foods. Just a couple here, trans fat free, preservative free, GMO free, foods that are free of soy, nuts, eggs, dairy. You know, in the end, my dad and I were sitting there looking at each other and a glass of water and thinking, that's about it. You know, you're left when you're all the free from, all you're left with is a glass of water. But nonetheless, this is a huge thing. So the food industry is faced with that. What do we do with it? And how do we produce foods that people want to eat, are comfortable eating, etc.? I'll put just a little bit out there for us to think about. I feel like the consumer wants to order the number 3 or the number 7 or whatever it is. You know, remember, you know, you used to go into a restaurant and you want this, you want that, and you want something else and a drink on the side, and now you just say, I'd like the number, you know, number 2, number 1, whatever it is. I think consumers just want to know that they're eating healthy. That's the number 1. I'd like to order the healthy. And we provide it already. We in agriculture, in food industry, in the sciences, we provide that. Walk into your store and look. You have access to more safe, healthy food than the history of the world. Nobody is telling you not to eat that tomato, the orange, the celery that came from California, the pineapple that came from South America, the nuts that came from Hawaii, wherever. Do we provide food? Yes, we do. Do we provide choices? Yes, we do. Is some of it good choices? No. Although a colleague says there are no bad foods, just bad choices. You know, I like donuts, but don't eat them every day. So I think in the end, between science, we will feed the world. With food and agriculture, we have the ability to do it. We can provide it to everybody. Where does that leave us in Indiana? So I want to kind of come to our state here and talk about just a couple of things that are passions of mine. It amazes me. I grew up in California. The amount of land and water that we have here is awesome. This state is a machine. It's a powerhouse. I feel like California industry is going to be coming here. We've got what agriculture needs. We need to push our educated workforce, though. Ivy Tech is a young community college system with all the potential in the world. If you are involved with Ivy Tech in this room, if you have the ability to be involved with it and push it, please do. We at Purdue are overwhelmed with applicants. Our state students, our kids in our state want to come to Purdue and IU and can't get in. Why? Well, we're top in the world. They are competing against the world. And we're going to take the best, because that's our job. But we have students in Indiana that need to go to college, and Ivy Tech, the community college system, is the path to do that. Ivy Tech needs to continue to evolve and be a stronger community college program. It needs to have full-time instructors. It needs to push those students into the four-year programs, as well as finish applied two-year programs for manufacturing. It's a passion of mine. Quality of life and health, I think people come for the cool factor, and we need to be advocates for that. Indianapolis, what a great city. I mean, again, being here just 2 years, but I love it. I mean, we've got pro sports, we've got arts and entertainment, the restaurant scene is growing, so we need to keep pushing that. All righty. Last bit, let's step through here. We've got terrific resources in our Indiana State Department of Agriculture with Sue, Ted, and a bunch of other people I've met. If I could be so informal, thank you for being here. We've got resources in the university system to build entrepreneurs, and we have students wanting to do that, to build entrepreneurs. And with that, I think the last bit in opportunities here, we've got to market Indiana's strengths and natural resources. I mean, coming from the outside, this is great stuff. We've got to increase our partnerships in educational systems and industry. Internships, mentoring and partnering that way, lots of potential there. Focusing on Indiana kids. Nobody wants to stay in Indiana as badly as an Indiana-raised person, a young man or woman. So keep that in mind. I'm big on development of microbiological-based manufacture. The biotech industry, biopharmaceutical industry, the food industry, in microbiological-based manufacturing, and finally, diversification of our agriculture base. Keep pushing that. We're tops in some areas. Keep pushing for diversification. All right, with that, I'd like to bring up our speakers. And the first that I'll introduce is Dr. Steve Braun. He is Vice President of Global Research and Development and Operations for Mead Johnson Nutrition. His full bio is in your pamphlet there, so you could read through there. But Steve, come on up. Thank you.
Okay. Well, good morning. What I'm going to talk about today, you've already been hit on by the team, so you won't see anything I think that is surprising of you. Let me digress for a little minute and tell you a little bit about Mead Johnson. We're located in Evansville. We've been there 100 years as of this year. And interesting enough, E. Mead Johnson, one of the Johnson & Johnson brothers, he came to Evansville for agricultural raw materials. So he came for corn, he came for water. And that's true for us today. I sometimes get the question when we're recruiting, why Evansville? And I tell people we're in the center of the world for agriculture, food science, and life sciences. Within, if you draw an arc 400 miles roughly north of us, you have covered every major food and ag research university, as well as the majority of the large food companies and food ingredients companies, as well as the production of those materials. We are in the center of the world here. I never tell anyone anything different. This is the center of the world. The themes I'm talking about today are ones that are not different than you've heard. GMO, clean labels, microbiome, and regulatory. You've heard all of those already. You've heard that Dr. Farkas talk about free from. We use that term internally also, but we also talk about no. People don't want GMO. They don't want additives. The interesting thing is, Dr. Farkas showed some numbers, is people want GMO free, but if you ask people what GMO is, they don't know, right? What that should tell you is that it's not about science. As a scientist, that is so frustrating for me. It's not about the science. It's about perception, right? And that's why what I consider this battle is disappointing, is that this battle will not be won on a science basis. It'll be one on a perception basis. And I actually believe we're at a tipping point. So let me run through a few slides fairly quickly. You can see, just looking at headlines, major food companies, major sellers, all making decisions. If McDonald's is going to cage-free eggs, if McDonald's won't use the GMO potato that doesn't have acrylamide, which should be a health advantage, right? Then who will? So we say internally, we think we're at a tipping point on GMO. I'm not sure which way it'll go. But I also know if you're an activist, I only need to win two battles. I simply need to get Coke or Pepsi to agree to use non-GMO sourced high fructose corn syrup. And I need to get someone like Walmart or one of the big food chains to say they'll go GMO free. The battle, they win those two battles, the war is over. Right? We won't have GMO materials really in our food supply. Europe, which has approved many GMO ingredients, has virtually none on the shelves because people won't label it and consumers don't want it. So it's not about the approval, it's not about safety, it's not about science, it's about perception. The next one here is microbiome. We have at the moment, we have been running for the last 3 or 4 years. I'm running at least 25 clinicals that are looking at gut-brain axis. I run about 75 clinicals a year. On any given year, we're running about a third of them are gut-brain axis. When we first started, people questioned it and said, how are we going to prove the benefit of microbiome to gut? And I give a story. I said, listen, I can show you that the microbiome or bacteria or parasites are so important that they're life and death issue. And the one I give them is how many know what toxoplasmosis is? Your wife can't empty the cat box, the cat litter box, right? But do you know that the parasite has a phase? It needs to go from, one of the carriers is a rat, and it needs to go through a cat to complete its life cycle. What the parasite does to the rat is it knocks out an olfactory sensor. The rat can't smell the cat. The rats with toxoplasmosis don't have a fear of cats because they can't smell them. This is lethal to the rat. There's no benefit whatsoever, right? The bug is controlling the rat. That's the example that I give. There are many other examples of this. So if you look at short chain molecules circulating in the blood, more than half of them are generated from microbiome. They're not generated by us. They're circulating byproducts from the microbiome. This is, I'll just echo what Dr. Farkas has said, is it is going to be a critical area of research over the next 5, 10, 20 years. Every major publication has had a special issue on this. If you look at Nature, I can put one up from Science. If you look at Penn Medicine, Scientific American, New York Times, is example after example. It is clearly one of the most important areas, new areas that we're working on. Again, I have more than 25 clinicals ongoing, some that are actually centered out of Purdue, by the way. We see that this is a critical area for us. There is a critical link between gut-brain axis. The last one to talk about is regulatory burden. People, I have roughly 400 research people around the world, and I have 100 regulatory people around the world, plus external affairs. So people sometimes say, you have research, and I say, no, I have regulatory is what I have. The burden for us is not so much that I have 100 people. It's a bit about what Kay talked about. It is the lengthening of the timeline. We find it acceptable to have a 7 to 10 year timeline. When we get beyond 10 year timeline, we basically said, listen, if we can't approve a new ingredient in 10 years, we don't go after it. If it's going to be 12, 14, 15 years, it's just too long a time frame for us. So we don't go further than that. And regulatory is pushing us out that far. This is just an ingredient assessment internally that we have for additives and whether we can use it or not. So you can see the complexity of it for infant formula. Again, just some articles, you can see the complexity and what we have for regulatory. So for us, those are really the three themes. Where do we end up from here? Well, I'm not sure. GMO, clean labels, I'm sure are going to extend. Organics are one of the fastest growing food categories. So we're certainly going to see an increase in that. Microbiome, I've already talked about, will be one of the most important research areas. And I don't think the regulatory burden is going to get less anytime soon. So let me stop there. Yeah.
Yeah, have a seat. I'd like to introduce our next panelist is Joe Birch from Clabber Girl. He's spent a number of years in the food industry on the service side and is coming to Clabber Girl in technical support and specialty sales, and I'll let him talk a little bit about what he's working on. It's been interesting.
Thanks, Beth. I appreciate you having us here. So what's new in food? You know, if I had to say the trend, I'm glad that I'm not far off base with everybody else who's been up here so far. But the trend, I would say the expectations of consumers have changed to the perceived health hazards. So Dr. Braun briefly touched on it, but the no-no list. We deal with the no-no list on a daily basis. These are no-no lists from three different organizations. You're going to see Whole Foods up there. There's also Panera, and there's also Kroger on their Simple Truths. But these things are gaining a ton of momentum in the retail grocery side and on the food service, even on the manufacturer side. But these no-no lists, they're pretty proud of them in marketing that they've done with these things. If you look at the Panera one has 82 different artificial preservatives, sweeteners. It also has color and flavorings on these lists. But they're committed to removing these things by 2016. Whether you agree with these perceptions or not, you can agree that in 2015 it's a great time to be in the food marketing business. So anyway, one current hot button for us on this list is the no artificial color, no artificial flavor. So we're working hard to develop in our dry mix dessert category some SKUs that are using flavors and colors from natural sources. Mind you, that any time that we try to do this, they are far more expensive. They are also far less intense. So to color a gelatin, per se, it would take me five times the amount of a natural color than it would its artificial counterpart. So there's layers of cost that are involved in that. The next one, everybody's touched on it. And it's the granddaddy. You can't have a food conversation out in the field without running into non-GMO. Whether you like it or not, these GMO perceptions are driving consumer manufacturer behaviors. And I feel like it's going to be here for a while. 5 years ago, I said, no way. This thing's going to come and go quick. It doesn't make any sense. But there's so many misconceptions about non-GMO. And just an illustration, we had a sales call on the East Coast and had a customer who wanted a non-genetically modified sodium bicarbonate. Now, sodium bicarbonate's a rock. I mean, it's never been alive. It's never going to be alive. But this guy was an industrial consumer. This guy was an experienced purchasing person. So the thing that's scary to us is if this guy is an industry leader and he doesn't understand what this is, what does the retail consumer in a grocery store really understand about non-genetically modified? So in the end, our salesman, he ended up selling him non-genetically modified sodium bicarbonate. So, two trends on non-GMO. One, the first one, value products that don't have a labeled non-GMO, they're not being perceived as quality anymore, and that's very concerning to us. The second is that non-GMO is no longer good enough. We're looking at Project Non-GMO Verified. If you have a SKU that's on the shelf that says non-GMO, the one that sells is the one with this blue label. So it's a layer of cost. It's two layers of cost for raw materials. But it's also a label change. And now with the possibility of state-by-state labels, it turns this into a real nightmare. But anyway, the GMO is very expensive. And I was eating dinner with Dr. Kerry Christensen last weekend. And he said to me, he said, Joe, we're only as particular about our food as we can afford to be. You know, it was one of those moments that was just, wow. I mean, that was well said. So the next one, trend, I thought it was worthy of talking about. I think non-GMO or gluten-free was huge a couple of years ago. That's all you heard about. So MPD group in New York came up with a slide, and they asked people about cutting back or avoiding gluten in their diet. And they say that in 2013, it really kind of reached its peak. The conversations we're having are mirroring that. So what we're looking at here is in 2014, manufacturers were still asking for gluten-free leavening solutions. And then going into Q4 of 15, those have really slowed down a bit. But let me say a bit. 9% of all new products developed that are going into grocery store are on a gluten-free platform. So that's a relative comment there. Last thing I'll leave you with on this is 2015, these perceptions of food are really driving us to new product differentiation. So we have the Clabber Girl brand. It's been a trusted resource for 88 years. We have no intention of changing this product whatsoever. But we have had to look at the Hearth Club brand. And the Hearth Club brand is for a value shopper in a dollar store type arena. But we're going to have some other products that are catering to these label-sensitive customers. So our Run for brand, if you look at that one, it's got the Project Non-GMO verified cornstarch. And we're getting that from a really great source. So. Anyway, we've got a few dry powdered mixes in the dessert line that we're going to have to differentiate. Some of those have to do with religious or dietary concerns, like vegan gelatins and those kind of things. But at the end of the day, the last thing I'll leave you with is the way we see the future of food right now is increased R&D, increased new product development, because really one size doesn't fit all anymore in the food industry. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe. Our last speaker is Andrew Utterback. He's a field agent for Ingredion, and I think he's going to speak to the company and the size and what they do. But he manages contracting and supply chain functions for the organization, and a very interesting part called True Trace that I hope he talks about, and just like country of origin that I mentioned, I think we're going to be seeing a lot more of that. So.
Yep. Thank you very much. So I'm going to apologize off the bat. I have a lot of slides, a lot of information. I could speak for 5 to 7 hours. I only got about 5 to 7 minutes. So I'll try to get it out there and spark some conversations, spark some ideas. But so first off, I want to start with a slide. You know, who we are, who Ingredion is. You know, a lot of times I say, hey, I'm from Ingredion, and people are like, you know, they kind of tilt their head, who's Ingredion? Well, if you're from Indianapolis, you might remember the old National Starch. So in 2010, Corn Products International purchased National Starch. Summer 2010, we rebranded as Ingredion. We're a specialty ingredient solution provider for food, beverage, pharmaceuticals, the industrial industry. We did over $6.3 billion in sales in 2013, over 11,000 jobs. So we're a big company. INGR on the stock exchange, Fortune 500. We're somewhere in the 300s, as far as I know. It's a couple years old data. So just kind of background on who we are. We're probably a step further back in the chain from Steve and from Joe. You know, you're never going to buy anything in an Ingredion bag. It's all going to be ingredients that are in somebody else's products. So kind of some background where I'm coming from Ingredion's viewpoint. So Beth asked for, you know, what are we seeing macro trends when it comes to kind of the nexus of food, health, and agribusiness? So from ours, we're really seeing three big things. We're seeing the push for clean label. You know, consumers want to be able to understand what's on the label. They don't want a lot of ingredients when it comes to their processed or packaged foods. Second would be non-GMO. I think we've just about every speaker has spoken about it. And third, which I think Karen might have mentioned, was sustainability. You know, consumers, not only do they want the product and they want it cheaply, but they want to know that it's going to be available and be available at a similar price and be good for the environment, for their kids and their kids' kids, so kind of into the future. So first, I'm going to talk a little bit about clean label. And if you look at that slide, so consumers are reading labels anymore. And they're not just reading labels because they want to learn some new big words. You know, they're reading, they're interested, they're concerned about what's going in there. So you see we're up 10% since 2006, and it's not just the United States. You see these global numbers. You know, people all over the world are reading their labels. So what are they looking for? One of the big things they're really looking for is clean label. They want simple ingredients. They don't want big chemical words. They want to understand what everything is. They're scared of the word modified. And then they want short lists. You know, if you buy a packaged product, say you buy a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, you want it to have, you know, 5 or 6 ingredients. You don't want it to have 47 ingredients, including 10 you've never heard of and couldn't pronounce. So it's really important. So kind of how Ingredion looked at this, and this kind of hits the ag side of it. So we have a plant breeding department. So we have scientists, PhD plant breeders. They work mostly on corn, but with some other raw materials. We wanted to address structure and stability, but have it in the corn plant itself. This isn't genetic modifications. It's through classical breeding. So what we did is we started with waxy maize, which is a hybrid of corn. It's its own kind of hybrid. And through classical breeding, and then we directed it with molecular marker technology, which is, again, is not a GMO. We're just identifying certain genes that we want and push those through to a final. We created a proprietary hybrid called Waxy Pro, and I'll kind of get into the starch structures here, I think. And so if you look at a regular waxy, you know, it's the starch molecule, it's branching, there's longer chains in it, gives a certain functionality. So if you move to the Waxy Pro, I might be one slide ahead, but so if you look at the Waxy Pro, shorter carbon chains, more branching, gives it more stability, whether it's in a process shear environment or with a freeze-thaw cycles, you know, going from frozen dinner and cooking it. So 20 years ago, if you guys would have made a frozen dinner, like a Salisbury steak, the gravy kind of curls up and it doesn't keep like the smooth, nice texture that you want. The only way to do that is by chemically modifying a waxy corn starch, and then you keep that nice. But the consumer sees modified food starch on the label. They're like, hey, I'm wholesome. I want clean label. I want natural. I don't like this word modified on here. So through Ingredion, we went through a prep plant breeding technique, and we decided, you know, I think we can put this structure into the plant itself. So if you look at the picture at the bottom, the one on the right side, I guess my right, is an unmodified waxy starch that tries to go through a 6-cycle freeze-thaw. So we freeze it, and then we thaw it, and we freeze it, and we thaw it. See how it gets chunky? And that's not what you'd want in a dressing or a gravy or something like that if you were a consumer or a restaurant or somebody preparing food. If you look on the right side, that is an unmodified waxy pro starch after the same freeze-thaw cycles. So you see, what we did is we went in a non-GMO, but we wanted to put the structure in the corn plant itself, and we did that through our PhD plant breeders. That's kind of how we hit our clean label targets for a lot of our products. Up next, I want to do a couple slides here on GMO. So if you look, it's hard to see the numbers, but from 2012 to 2013, there's an increase in awareness of both genetically modified foods and genetically modified organisms. And I think if you were looking at this data for 2014, that curve would be at even more of an intense angle. You know, consumers now know a GMO. Well, they know of it. I wouldn't say they know what it is, but they know of it. I think we would all agree on that. We're probably of similar opinions in this room. So they're more aware of GMO. And then more importantly, probably, is this next slide. Not only are they aware, but they have certain ideas about how it affects them. So there's a 10% increase in how it affects my health. There's an increase in how they feel like it affects the environment. And then you also see there is an increase in how they think it affects their own health and the environment. And pretty universally, when a consumer thinks that GMO affects their health, they consider it a negative. They're not saying GMO is, you know, helping their health or helping the environment. Pretty universally, they have a negative feeling on it. So when you look at it from Ingredion, you know, we trust the science of GMOs. Most of our manufacturing facilities use GMO. But here in Indianapolis, it's an all non-GMO facility. So we have the TrueTrace system, which Dr. Farkas mentioned for a second. Traceability all the way through from farmer, field planted, all the way through the supply chain to final product. We can trace forward and backward throughout the supply chain to prove to non-GMO. And through TrueTrace, we actually have non-GMO project verified starches coming out of Indianapolis. So say Joe, for his one corn starch product, says, hey, I need non-GMO project certified. You know, we can provide that to our customers. So Ingredion, we're really worried about kind of filling niches. You know, we think GMO is fine, but there's a niche or a place in the market for non-GMO, you know, we try to hit that as well. And then the final is sustainability, which has been mentioned a couple times today. So, you know, we get a lot of feedback from consumers. We get a lot of feedback from our customers. And sustainability has really been building. You know, it's one of those buzzwords. And I think you ask everybody in this room and you get 75 different definitions of what sustainability is. You know, it's not one thing. You know, some people think of it as sourcing sustainability. Some people think of it as a labor, you know, no child labor, you know, no bribes, things like that. So in Ingredion, we tried to create a wide-ranging, kind of wide idea of what sustainability is. So in 2015, we rolled out our Company of Choice program. You can kind of see the details here. There's 8 different windows that we look and what we consider in the sustainability window. for this audience today, I just wanted to kind of highlight a couple points of our sustainable sourcing. So I don't have all these numbers memorized, so I got to step and look at the slide real quick. But so we're looking to do 1 million metric tons of raw material sourcing in a sustainable fashion by 2018. And when we say in a sustainable fashion, this is verified through third parties. So in the U.S., we're using the Field to Market program. Not sure if you guys are aware, but it's basically a kind of a farm sustainability. It takes data from the farmers, pours it into like a big matrix, and then it can kick out, you know, a sustainability score, and it can do it based on local level, a state level, or a national level. So in the U.S., we're using that. In Europe, there's a thing called the Sustainable Agriculture Initiative, SAI platform. So we're members of that. And, you know, then we just work a lot with our major food and beverage companies that, you know, they all have sustainability agendas as well. We would prefer one sustainability metric to hold ourselves to versus one for Walmart, one for Unilever, one for Pepsi, one for Coke. So that's kind of why we came out with this Company of Choice program. And then some of these goals you see here on these slides to kind of, you know, show that we're interested, we care about sustainability, and we want to hit, you know, what our consumers and what the customers are looking for. So sorry if I went a little fast, had a short time, but those are kind of the three macro trends that we see in the health and ag and business side. So I'll be up here, we'll do the panel, and I think Dr. Farkas is going to come back up and kind of lead us through some.
Thank you. Yep.
We've covered some really great topics between me, Johnson, Clabber Girl, and Ingredion, and hearing some of the big trends. In the interest of time, what I'd like to do is, because we did cover a number of topics, is bring up our kind of closing speaker, David Brooker, recognizing that some of you have to be out of here by 10 o'clock. Let Dave get a piece in there, and then ask those who can stay around to stay around and engage with our panelists in discussion on, I would suggest, microbiome, recognizing that this is human microbiome, but what we also didn't talk about was soil microbiome, animal, non-human microbiome, as well as insect microbiome, and where those things go. Let me introduce Dave Brooker. He is the president and CEO of Indiana Biosciences Research Institute. He is described himself as a serial entrepreneur. I don't know if that means you can't hold a job down, David, but I will see. He received his...
Just like an entrepreneur, as many things fail as they succeed.
That's right. He received his BS in chemistry from Wabash College right here in Indiana, graduate degrees at MIT and an MBA from University of Chicago. That I'll turn it over to David.
Thank you, thank you.
All right.
So we do have a bit of a hard stop. We were notified before the event started that there's actually going to be a fire drill today. And we are on the 48th floor. So you can imagine walking down 48 floors or floors to get out when the fire alarm goes off. Or we can all get out on time and make the elevator. So I'm going to try to be very brief. The Indiana Bioscience Research Institute, people have already alluded to it. It is a standalone institute. It was really driven by the life science companies here in the state. Lilly, Cook, Roche, Biomet Zimmer, Dow, proud partner with the IBRI, in addition with the academic institutions here in the state, IU, School of Medicine, Purdue, Notre Dame. What we're really trying to do is create a place in the middle between industry and our research universities where we can attract somewhere between 100 to 200 world-class scientists, researchers, engineers to come into the institute. Our focus is metabolic disease, so a lot of the themes that you heard today and why everything from food production to animal health to then human health is so, so important. You know, at the end of the day, when you think about diseases like diabetes and obesity and the complications associated with that, whether that's cardiovascular disease or others, it really does boil down to probably everything that your mother told you. You are what you eat. So if you can eat healthy, if you can, you know, moderation with, you know, alcohol, exercise, you'll live a long, healthy life. What binds everybody together, what I find interesting as I work with the scientists from all of these companies, you know, you might say, well, what does a pharmaceutical company have to do with a medical device company that has to do with an agro-science company with an animal health? Well, it all comes down to biology, you know. Life science, biology, the study and science of life, and you know, we're all connected. If you go back, this is sort of the tree of life. If you Google tree of life, you see that we're all connected, whether that's bacteria, whether that's plants, whether that's animals, ultimately leading to, you know, the top of the biological chain, if you will, human beings. What's interesting about this is, if you look at the complexity of the biology, in many respects, the human genome is the simple one. Kay alluded to it. When you look at the plant genome, when you look at animal genomes, and you measure it by things like just the number of genes that you're working with, this is just a picture of the complexity associated with that. The box represents, like the human genome, which I think is on the bottom there, represents about 20,000 and 25,000 genes. You can see just for one species that Dow might be interested in, rice, it's probably 50% greater than that, probably somewhere on the order of 35 to 40,000. And they're interested in multiple genomes, not just rice, but corn and others. So when you think about that complexity of biology, all of these companies are heavy investors in research and development. And it starts with this understanding of the complex biology. What's interesting about the IBRI is this notion then of convergence and how you take the biology of what someone's interested in. We've talked about the environmental effects that wrap around that biology, whether that's the microbiome or those are other environmental effects. And then you think about how do you introduce technology into an understanding of driving further insight for innovation, discovery, those types of things. When I talk to the scientists and researchers that are around the Institute, this is what's driving them. Had you told me, and I'll show you here in a second, let me just get to this one. If you look at what our focus is in terms of content, we're still defining it because we haven't hired our first researcher into the Institute. But when you talk to the scientists from the stakeholder companies, these are the things that they're looking to the IBRI to help provide. Deep biological understanding, bioinformatics and computational analytics. How do you process all of this data? I read a statistic where for a typical PhD biologist, whatever field they're in, there's so much biological data that's being generated that it would take them over 150 hours per day just to sort through all the biology that's hitting them. Now, you only have 24 hours in a day, so there's no way a normal human being with their brain, as smart as they are, can process that information. So this role of technology and how that gets introduced and how you use and leverage artificial intelligence types of algorithms and computational techniques to sort of sort through things and look for connections, that's a very, very important aspect of this. And as we move beyond just the biology, what we're interested in, into some of these other environmental effects, you can just think of the complexity of that. But it's going to be very, very important for these companies, industry players, and at a university level to figure out how do you create the tools, how do you create the capabilities to make those things happen. So that's one of the things from an IBRI that we're trying to establish and some of the capabilities we're trying to build. I'll just say two more things. Innovation is very, very important. Our tagline, if you will, is discovery with a purpose. It's not discovery for discovery's sake. It really is this notion of how do you translate discovery into innovation. We want to have an impact. We want to bring in scientists. We want to bring in engineers that want to do research that have an impact on life, whether that's, you know, agriculture, whether that's animal, whether that's human life. We want that. And so we are now working with the city, trying to get my bearings here. I guess it's over there. We're working with the city on taking some land in an area that's been referred to as 16 Tech in the city of Indianapolis. I don't know how many folks are familiar with that, but this is essentially a photograph of that area. 10th Street is on the bottom of the chart, and just below that, off the chart, on the wall below those screens, would be the IU School of Medicine campus and IUPUI below that. The top of the screen is 16th Street, and then you see that diagonal road that goes across. That's essentially Indiana Avenue. So that's the area of the city, which is literally just looks like over here on the northwest side of the city. So that's going to be our place. And what we've been doing recently is working with developers, architects, the city, to essentially come up with the notion of an innovation community here in the city. So we just have been working with the city council to issue $75 million worth of bonds to prepare the infrastructure in that area with roads and bridges and rerouting of utility lines. But the goal over time is this is a 20-year, 25-year sort of picture of what the innovation community could be. It really becomes a place to bring people together from across the state into the city. Collaborations are just absolutely critical. People do studies where you look at the amount of collaboration that occurs if you're on the same floor of a building versus in the same building versus within the same city versus, you know, across states. Proximity matters in this type of thing. And so what we're trying to do is establish a truly a world-class innovation hub, if you will, that's open, broad-based here in Indianapolis. So with that, I will turn it back to questions, answers, fire drill.
Okay. Fire drill. So join me in thanking all of our speakers this morning. As Brian said, I think we will have a little bit of time for maybe some individual conversations with some of our panelists. That fire drill, Joe Beth has told me, is set hard time at 10:30. So we do have, if those of you who are here and have some interest in connecting with some of our speakers can stay and mingle or network, that is the time that the horns will start blaring and the elevators will become jammed. So use your time efficiently. I'll just leave it at that. My final comments, I just want to close by saying I hope that we have successfully connected some dots for you. There still are, I think, many more subjects, many more of these topics that we could have done far deeper dives into. And I can tell you from a BioCrossroads and an AgriNovus perspective, you will continue to see, though, I think, develop more and more of these very strategic and very specific, very structured initiatives like IBRI really come together and utilize the talents and the skills and the people and the entrepreneurial spirit and the research that is so prevalent here in Indiana already across our food and ag, our biosciences, our life sciences, our pharma, and our medical sectors. This is one of those areas where our consultants at Battelle had told us as we really launched the AgriNovus initiative, this is a space where you have to start bringing these assets together. The success comes when you and Indiana start having dialogues, conversations, bringing people in a room like we are here this morning to start talking about these same trends and factors. So from a hopefully we have accomplished something and gotten all of you thinking about new and different trends and these intersection points, that's what we really hope to accomplish with this morning's session. So thank you very much for taking the time to be here. The last thing I will tell you is we do have at AgriNovus two more Innovation Council meetings coming up. We have organized Innovation Councils, technical advisory committees around our four innovation sectors. September 24th is our Plant Sciences Innovation Sector Council meeting, and September 30th we'll have a similar meeting focused around animal health and nutrition. Those will both be in the afternoon here in Indianapolis, and as we have your information, we'll make sure that you all get a notification with more details about both of those meetings. But those are open. We'd love for you to participate in those if either one of those sectors is especially intriguing or interesting to you. We have outside speakers who come to those as well. We spend about 2.5 hours kind of talking a little more deeply about those particular sectors of ag biosciences. So thank you again for coming. Safe travels and enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you.